I can't quite believe I'm wearing open-toed sandals on the second Sunday of January, but welcome to climate change? I don't know. So. On that note. So as Leslie said in the introduction, this morning part of my sermon will be telling the story of Christian Peacemaker Teams, which is one of the institutions or communal efforts that Mennonites were a part of in the 20th century. And unlike Ken Sensenig, who shared last week, and unlike Kevin King and Vanessa Hofer, who will be sharing in 2 weeks, they are actually currently employed or active in those organizations. And I've never served with CPT, although I've been sort of a passionate follower of what CPT does. I won't be speaking from the perspective as a representative of Christian Peacemaker Teams. One of the pieces of the Mennonite Central Committee story that Ken Sensenig shared last week is how quickly MCC came to be. Basically, within 1 month of identifying a need of fellow Mennonites back in Russia, a group of Mennonites here had begun to respond, and not only that, but they had not just made that response, but like had decided that they were going to be, you know, an organized group of people that responds to these things. So Mennonite Central Committee had a 1 month gestation period, basically. For anybody who's worked in a church organization, you know that that's pretty miraculous. Well, CPT had a relatively short gestation period, although not in the months, not in the time frame of months. It emerged in a time in the mid-1980s, and some of this I'll literally be reading from the history that they have put out of their origin story. So at that time in the 80s, there were already members of the historic peace churches, the Church of the Brethren, Mennonite, Friends, or Quakers, were seeking new ways to express their faith. Low-intensity wars, their phrase, had broken out in many places, including Central America, and the U.S. government usually sided with the elite groups and oppressive systems in those conflicts. And also emerging in that period was a consciousness that by using the creative energy of organized violence, organized nonviolence, ordinary people could stand in front of the weapons and encourage less violent ways for change to happen. And then, in 1984, Ron Sider, a well-known evangelical speaker and author, challenged the Mennonite World Conference when it was being held in Strasbourg, France, with these words, and this is an excerpt. You can actually read his entire address, which is a really interesting read. This is just a small excerpt of it. Over the past 450 years of martyrdom, immigration, and missionary proclamation, the God of Shalom has been preparing us Anabaptists for a late 20th century rendezvous with history. The next 20 years will be the most dangerous and perhaps the most vicious and violent in human history. If we are ready to embrace the cross, God's reconciling people will profoundly impact the course of world history. This could be our finest hour. Never has the world needed our message more. Never has it been more open. Now is the time to risk everything for our belief that Jesus is the way to peace. If we still believe it, now is the time to live what we have spoken. He goes on, we must take up our cross and follow Jesus to Golgotha. We must be prepared to die by the thousands. Those who believed in peace through the sword have not hesitated to die. Proudly, courageously, they gave their lives. Again and again, they sacrificed bright futures to the tragic illusion that one more righteous crusade would bring peace in our time, and they laid down their lives by the millions. Unless we are ready to start to die by the thousands, he challenged, in dramatic, vigorous new exploits for peace and justice, we should sadly confess that we never really meant what we said. And we dare never whisper another word about pacifism to our sisters and brothers in those desperate lands filled with injustice. Unless we are ready to die, developing new nonviolent attempts to reduce conflict, we should confess that we never really meant that the cross was an alternative to the sword. These were strong words, and Sider's call spoke directly to this cultural moment in the historic peace churches and contributed to vigorous conversations in churches across North America. I wasn't a part of those at that time. I think I was probably in children's time, but this is what I have heard. So in 1986, the discussions that bubbled up around people wanting to take seriously this question that Sider put to Mennonite World Conference resulted in a gathering of 100 people in Chicago, I believe. And from this gathering, a call went out for the formation of Christian peacemaker teams. Representative denominations, Mennonite Church being one of them, appointed a steering committee to hammer out basic directions. And Jean Stoltzfus was the first hired staff person, and that was in 1988. By 1992, CPT had put together a series of delegations to Haiti, to Iraq, and West Bank. And then they began to develop this kind of two-tier system of a Christian peacemaker core, where they had a core, CORPS, of 12 people who would have a stipend and would be kind of full-time working for CPT. And then they would have reservists, what they called, who would come in and supplement and stand beside the Christian Peacemaker Corps. And those people would be donating their time and resources to do that. So what exactly do CPTers do, you might ask? CPT places teams, and this is one of the things that has changed over the years, I think, from learnings of theirs, that they place teams at the invitation of local peacemaking communities that are confronting situations of lethal conflict. These teams support and amplify the voices of local peacemakers who risk injury and death by waging nonviolent direct action to confront systems of violence and oppression. So CPT work includes accompanying partners as they work nonviolently to defend their rights and communities. CPT work includes advocacy, amplifying the stories and voices of those experiencing violent oppression. They work through human rights observation and reporting. I think a lot of the groups that go to the West Bank with CPT, for example, are doing witnessing there and observing and reporting. CPT does solidarity networking, partnering with individuals and organizations to work toward change. Their a key understanding is that violence, they understand violence to be rooted in systemic structures of oppression. And so they are committed to undoing oppressions, starting within our own lives and in the practice of their organization. CPT enlists spiritual communities and individuals in an organized, nonviolent alternative to war. And although CPT's roots were among Mennonites, Church of the Brethren, and Quaker, they are now supported by peace fellowships within other religious groups and denominations as well, to support spiritually centered peacemaking, creative public witness, nonviolent direct action, and protection of human rights. Now, I was a college student at Eastern Mennonite University, college then, soon to be university, from 93 to 97. So CPT was really getting off of its feet at that time. And I was a religion major with a peace and justice minor, and I was very active in EMU's student peace fellowship. So during those years, our peace fellowship was meeting up with peace fellowships from other colleges, meeting up with other Mennonite, Quaker, Anabaptist organizations, and it seemed like every year there was a peace conference of some sort that we would meet up at. And the folks who were actively involved in starting CPT, they were attending the same conferences I was attending, and so it felt very near and very tangible and very exciting. The following example admittedly probably sprang to my mind because my family binge-watched Star Wars over Christmas. But for those of you who are familiar, Rogue One is actually sort of episode 3.5 in the line of 9 movies. But there's a character in Rogue One who's blind, but is a character that's clearly very attuned to the Force, as Star Wars puts it in their universe. And at one point, this blind man is tasked with activating a device in the middle of a shootout between Imperial and Rebel Alliance troops. Plenty of other people who could see tried and all failed. He realizes he's the only one left and decides he's going to go for it. So he calmly holds his sword in front of him, point down, and simply begins to walk calmly straight into the field toward a device that he cannot see. And he speaks to himself as he walks through laser beams and pew-pew-pews. If you're Star Wars people, you know what I mean. Yeah. His mantra is, "The Force is with me, I am one with the Force. The Force is with me, I am one with the Force." And walks through to that device to activate it for what they're trying to do to take down the Empire. If you cross that image with the image of the brave young Chinese person who walked out in front of the tanks in Tiananmen Square, you'll get a little bit of an idea of how I pictured the work of CPT as a college student in my 20s and late teens. It's what Ron Sider's words sounded like to me, an invitation to some almost magical way to be present in a nonviolent way in a battlefield. A very different way of thinking about pacifism than I had mostly heard about growing up. If I have a critique of Sider's words now, in retrospect, it probably lies in the phrases like, "this could be our finest hour," or the way it seems to kind of imply that Anabaptists have the key to save the world, if only we'd be brave enough to use it. I happen to believe nonviolence probably is the key, but I also realize that I'm speaking from someone like very much nurtured in this tradition. If you read his entire address to World Conference, though, there are a lot of profoundly valid questions. Too often, he says, we fall into an isolationist pacifism, which silently ignores or perhaps profits from injustice and war as long as our boys don't have to fight. Sider calls for a third option in that speech, to prayerfully and nonviolently place ourselves between the weak and the oppressor, which is a profoundly Christ-like and Jesus-modeling positioning, standing between the woman at the well and the stones that others were threatening to throw at her, hanging from the cross, hoping to save us from ourselves by modeling a refusal to continue the cycle of retributive violence. But such a positioning was dangerous for Jesus, and as Sider said very clearly, would be dangerous now as well. Do we believe Jesus enough to pay the price of following him? Do you? Do I? Those were his closing words, his closing question in Strasbourg, France that year, that out of which the groups developed that took the serious time to discuss and create Christian peacemaker teams. When I chose my sermon title for today, I was enamored of the idea that a speaker's question could have such resonance that groups of people would gather to ponder it and Christian peacemakers or something like this would grow out of it. I thought it lined up so nicely with the story that Marty put together, telling the story of the bucket of coins, because the coins were all gathered at someone's invitation. What power the right question must have, I mused. And I think there is power in the right question at the right time. But I really think the thread that carries between the story of Ron Sider's question that produced CPT and Melinda's question, and the story of the feeding of the 5,000, which Jean read for us this morning, was the belief of the asker, either that the question could be answered, could be responded to, or their belief that doing something, trying, was better than not doing anything at all, even if that felt more logical. Ron Sider believed that there was capacity to respond in the audience to whom he spoke at Mennonite World Conference. He believed that giving nonviolence a try was something that we had the capacity to do and was worth trying. My guess is neither Marty nor Melinda dreamed that we could collect $750 in, was it just December? In the Sundays of Advent?
November, December.
From congregational loose change, essentially. But they thought there was capacity to respond, and so they asked. In the story of the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus doesn't even ask. But when the disciples say to him, "Here are all these people, surely you're going to tell them to go away and like find some food at the next village, right?" And Jesus said, "Yeah, they're hungry and it's a problem." But the story doesn't have him multiplying the loaves and fishes. Jesus says, "They don't have to go away. You give them something to eat." And he asks them to bring the loaves and fishes, and he blesses them. It doesn't say that suddenly there were more loaves and fishes. Somehow, after the distribution of the few loaves and fishes, there was leftover. That's all we know. What was the miracle? I've heard it said that the miracle is that Jesus' blessing created loaves and fishes out of nothing. I've heard it said that the miracle was that in the distribution, folks miraculously felt generous enough to share what they had with them, and it all added up to way more than needed. Both are miracles. One, perhaps a more random act of kindness, a one-off, a miracle. The other, a more complicated one. One in which people who did not believe, or who were at least deeply skeptical, responded to a question, a suggestion, a need anyway. Responded to Jesus' invitation to pass out what they had. And in their willingness to start and keep walking around, reaching into the basket and handing things out, they somehow kept having the capacity to continue the miracle. In talking through this passage some with Taman recently, he told me that he thinks that the miracle is that Jesus got a crowd of people to stop following the empire's rules of ownership, to look at the provisions that are actually around and distribute them. In our world now, and it might not be true in years to come, there actually is enough to eat. But food isn't always in the right place. Or it's in the right place, but we all communally acknowledge that it is owned by someone or some organization, and so it is not available, and so there is a scarcity. We allow others to go hungry because we honor ownership over being fed. Jesus' miracle of feeding the 5,000 would have terrified the Roman occupiers in this understanding because it was reminding people to see differently and to remember their human dignity and their bodies and their hunger and to honor that over ownership. However you want to interpret it, this story is a story of responding to a need, being asked by someone who believes there is enough and believes in our capacity to give, to act, to respond. In council this year, we are developing CMCL's goals for 2020-2025. We took a lot of feedback from you all, and we'll be coming back to you with our ideas. But it's been an active part of council meetings in the past couple of months. And one of the things that came through clearly from folks' feedback in this process is that we don't want to gather together and just gather together and believe things in common. We want to act together, and we believe that acting together will be an important way of knowing each other in a deeper way and being community together. The word act came up over and over in our feedback. I think Jesus believes that there are miracles waiting to happen. Ron Sider believed in us. Marty and Melinda believe in us. I believe in us. And actually, I should have told you. Can you turn the screen on? I was supposed to give Melinda a cue about 30 seconds ago. And I try to talk slowly. And we are from an extended family, culturally, as Mennonites, that does things like this, which we will see in a minute, hopefully. We have this funny thing that if the screen works great before the service, in the middle of the service, like, it doesn't always. There we go. So, in this clip, you'll see there was a barn that needed to be moved 200 feet. No problem. 250 men showed up and carried it. They carried the dang barn. You'll see it. And just wait a minute, because they didn't set it down right the first time, so, you know, gotta adjust it here a little bit, make sure it's just right. So, it's a mix of video and stuff. Yeah, gotta get it just right. So, we come from a people who are very matter-of-fact and very creative. Need to move a barn? Well, we got 250 of us. We may not be able to move mountains, but we come from people who move barns and build them. And there's a video of a, sort of a time lapse of a barn raising, which we're all very familiar with. So they will happily time lapse the barn here as I finish up. Oh, or we'll have an ad, of course. Yeah, you can turn the music off. I like bluegrass, but I don't think we need it this morning. And finally, having just come from the Laurelville Music and Worship Leaders Retreat, I was literally there Friday and Saturday, and a number of CMCLers are still there, I'm reminded of something else. In the Mennonite community, I believe it's called the Mennonite Community Cookbook, by Mary Emma Showalter, you can find the ingredient list and recipes to feed a community doing just this. Food for a barn raising. Enough for 175 men. Page 455. The list is 115 lemon pies, 500 fat cakes, which is apparently a word for donuts, 15 large cakes, 3 gallons of applesauce, 3 gallons of rice pudding, 3 gallons of cornstarch pudding, 16 chickens, 3 hams, 50 pounds of roast beef, 300 light rolls, 16 loaves of bread, red beet pickle and pickled eggs, cucumber pickle, 6 pounds of dried prunes stewed, 1 large crock of stewed raisins, and 5 gallon stone jar white potatoes, and the same amount of sweet potatoes. And all those recipes are in the book. You don't build a barn or move a mountain or solve world peace on an empty stomach. Jesus knew that. He said, feed the people, duh. Being in Laurelville singing together, praying together was another form of nourishment for work. I felt very strongly this weekend. When we are gathered here, for me, that is nourishment. And we need that to do this. So I invite you to think about that as we have communion this Sunday. I tried to think of some creative way to do communion that would sort of make it seem all like we all brought stuff and there was a barn raising and we all had lemon pies, and I couldn't come up with it. So we're just having regular communion. But I invite you to think about that as we're sharing this meal together, that the point of this meal is to nourish us too for the work we believe we are called to do. So may we be seers of the need, askers of the obvious questions, motivators of one another to respond, and let us be responders even to impossible attempts to build and fix and repair and feed, and to stand between people and the violence we say we abhor. Who knows what might happen if we give ourselves to the person and peace